And Dan and Jack was in between. Well, anyhow, old Becker was living there. There was lots of moose around and fish, you see, so difficult swarm, and you know, he raced them on off the country. And anyhow, so Harry and old Jim Becker used to was in Livingston, so he know Harry very quite well, and Henry Abb was over there. So they didn't do much prospecting up there, but they sat there at the bars for a lot. They had lots of vegetable and lots of moose meat and everything. So anyhow, they one day they were sitting out in front of the cabin, and here's the river going by, and right above where the Boswell comes in, there's quite a bank in the river, and you cannot see up the river, but you can see down the river quite a ways. But they were looking up. Here's a raft coming around the bend, and well, who's coming down the river on a raft? So when the raft came down, it was Eddie Mackay. So he pulled in. Eddie didn't know where he was, but he had hit the river, and he was going down the river. He'd get out somewhere there. So when he's in the cabins, he pulled in. It was Eddie. So he stayed with them overnight, and had a good feed. He was all starved out. He'd been through the woods for maybe 2-3 weeks, you see. He didn't know where he was. So he wanted to go to Whitehorse, so they told him to go as far down the river as Winter Crossing. That's about 40 miles down the river. And then they told him there's a trail leading up over the hill. To follow that trail, that brings him out to Lake Labarge. So next morning, Eddie was taking off with the raft down the river. And of course, they give him some grog to get on, because he had nothing with him, just a gun. And he left, and them fellas, they were sitting around there, you know, just passing the time. They was waiting for Taylor and Drury's boat to come up, and then they go down the river with Taylor and Drury, the Yukon Rose, you see. Anyhow, they was waiting there for about a week. And one night they were sitting outside the cabin. There's a raft coming around the bend again and one man on it. Well, who in the world is that, you see? Damn days nobody came down the river, because there was nothing above except Teslin, you see. And they would come to the boat, you see. When they came close, it was Eddie Mackay again. He went down the river 40 miles, and then he started out over the mountain, coming over to Lake Labarge, but he got lost, and he kept on wandering, and finally he came out to a river. So he built a raft, and he went down the river. So the second time when he came down the river, so they told him where he got lost. They asked him different questions, where he went and how he went and which valley he took, you see, coming over to Labarge. And well, they told him where he met the mystic, and next time he should go that way. And I was in Livingston at the time, and I came out to order the crop for next year, you see. We had to order this a year ahead all the time, and I had to catch the Dillon and Drury's boat to bring it up the river. So I didn't know that Eddie Mackay was on the trail, but I came in, and I was here, and Tom Carush came in too, and we started out, and Tom Carush, he says, well, yeah, you just as well wait for me, we go back together. I said, okay, and I waited a couple of days here for him, and when he was ready, we started out. And I remember George Cargill and Bert Fowler was on a Saturday. They went down duck hunting down to Lake Labarge, and the Duke was down there. The Duke was across the slough down there at Lake Labarge, so we could keep on going. Otherwise, you got to walk around that big slough for about 5 miles. Anyhow, Tom Carew said, I have a boat over on the Hood Link River. We do not have to build a raft to cross the river. So we walked across. When we got to the river, there was no boat there. Well, who in the world took the boat? And On the way from Lake Lebarge over, I see where there was somebody walking on the trail. I could see in the softer places. And I could see where he shot a crouch, and he made a fire right there, and he ate it, so I know he was hungry. Mm-hmm. I said to Dom, that man is hungry, whoever he is, you see, and wherever he is going, you see. So we had to build a raft and got across the river. And Dom, of course, he stayed there for a couple of days to rest off. Dom was pretty old, you see. And I went next day to Livingston, and I inquired who came over the trail. So I found out it was Eddie Market. He got lost that time again. And he walked back, you see. That's where I seen his track, you see. Well, and they fixed him up in Livingston with a little drop when he started out again. But by this time it was getting cold in the fall, you know, started to freeze. And he had no blankets. So he made two fires. And he lay between the two fires. And when he woke up, he was so played out. One fire had burned up to his back and burned the clothes off his back. He was all bare. And just imagine what that is in the fly time, in the fall of the year, when the black flies are bad. But he ran into some Indians. They was hunting caribou for the winter meat. And they give him the squaws, they saw a caribou hide on his back. to cover his back. Well, and then they put him on the track, and he still got lost, but he finally made it out to Lake Lebarge. And you know old Dutch Henry squaws, the old squaw?
No, I don't remember.
Well, Maggie was her name, I remember. She was out hunting gopher. And of course them squaws, they always carry a 22. And here's something coming through the bush. And she thought, what is this, a bear? And it was Eddie Market. He had wore all his clothes. He had no pants left in front. It was all bare skin from walking through the bush, you see. And for weeks, everything was wore out. And on the back, he had this caribou skin. So she took him into the Indian camp there, to Dutch Henry. And they fed him up. And next day, they brought him with the boot into Whitehorse. That's the last trip Eddie Market left. He said, oh my.
I still think that story of yours about Eddie, the three axes, all right?
Oh yeah, the Lobuschuk boys. You remember that?
No, I don't remember.
I think you was married then, eh?
No, he worked on the dock, I remember. He was related to Louis Moy somewhere, wasn't he?
I do not know if they was related or not. But anyhow, there was two brothers. They was Ukrainian fellas born on the prairie, you know, out in Saskatchewan somewhere. Mm-hmm. And you know how it was, there was no trap line, registered trap lines here them days. You could go anywhere as long as you didn't trespass on anybody else, you know, but there was no registered trap line. They came into Whitehorse, and I came in from Livingston. I was taking a grub stick for next year, you see. I started to work on my own there on Cottonwood Creek, and I came in to get all the stuff I needed. And I had quite an outfit, grub for a couple of years, and tools, and all kinds of stuff, you see. Anyhow, they asked me if there was a chance that they could do some trapping over there during the winter. Well, I said, there's nobody around. There's some trappers there, but they do not go very far. Well, if they would hang about 20 or 30 miles, if they could, oh sure, there's nobody trapping around there. So they came over there, and we went on the Yukon Road from here, and went up the Hood Link, and then they got off with their outfit. They had their own outfit, they brought it in from outside. And so we went into Livingston. And they went out and they built a couple of trapper cabins out about 20 miles out of Livingston. One they built on Loon Lake and another one farther on. And anyhow, they came back to Livingston. They found out they was not going to have enough grub for the winter. By this time it was getting very late in the fall, you know, and it started to freeze and snowing. So they decided, George, he decided to come into Whitehorse to get another load of grub. And I had a couple of dogs, and he asked me if he could have my dogs to come in. And they had a dog, so they had three dogs. And I said, all right, I didn't need the dogs yet because there was not enough snow for to bring my stuff in yet from the river to Livingston. Mm-hmm. And so George started out. Well, he didn't. They only had one axe between them, so he didn't want to take the axe he had because the other fellow wouldn't have him. So he asked if I had a drill axe. I said I got one, but I need it myself. He said. So Bill Clitter was there. He says, "Well, I got an old one. I can let you have if you bring me a new one." So that was fine. And I told him, I says, "You just let them dogs go. They've been over the trail about 3-4 times. They know the trail well." I says, "Do not try to steer them off anywhere. They go, they take you in the right way." So he left. Well, he was supposed to be gone. It takes them 2 days to come in. And then a day or two here, and then he should be back within a week or 10 days anyhow. Well, I waited 2 weeks. And it, meanwhile it snowed quite a bit and everything, the lakes were froze. I wanted to get going on my hauling. I had quite a bit. I had about 2 tons of stuff to haul. So I started, I says, "I'm going and look for him." So I started out and I met him about halfway between Lake Labarge and the Hoodling. Just on the divide there I meet him. He had such a heavy load. He had his three dogs and fresh snow. He had to break the trail. And he had about 400 pounds on the sleigh. Well, that, so he had to relay all the time, you see. And then he drove the dogs so hard for a start, he played them all out, you see, and never fed them properly. Anyhow, he started out when he started out from here for Livingston, he bought 3 axes. One for him, one for Bill Cledron, he bought 2 axes. He had the old one and 2 new ones. And he started out here and he tested the ice on the river. And if he didn't, with the first strike, he hit a rock. And the blade chipped right off. So he threw it away. It's no good to him. And he started out. He has still one new one and the old one. Well, he got down to the mouth of the Kinney that first day. He sees new snow and deep snow, and a heavy load. That's as far as he got to the mouth of the Kinney. And he met Kent there. Well, he go first, he unhitched the dogs and tied them up. And then he started a fire. And then he go out and chop some wood for the night. And then he started to back in. And the first load he backed in, he bring in the axe and he leaned it against the tree. And he go out and bring another log in. And by the time he smelled something funny, and then he noticed that the fire had melted the snow away where he had put the axe, and the axe fell over and fell in the fire and had burned the handle off. That was the second axe. Well, then everything went worked all right. He still had the old one, you see. But this time he took the old, that one, the thin one along. He can put another handle in, you see. So anyhow, until I meet him, what he did, he relayed, you see, half the load, and then he go back and he stay overnight, and then next day he go ahead about 5-6 miles with half the load, come back and bring the next up and so on. Well, when I meet him, it was around 11 o'clock in the morning. He had just left the camp from the night before, and he had a load on the sled, about 200 pounds, and I had broken trail, you see, coming. I walked on snowshoes all the way. That's about 15 miles out from the Hood Links where I met him. And I had a hunch that he probably drove the dog so hard and no dog feet. So every time I see a rabbit, I shoot one, you see, and hang it up alongside the trail, and I know we would need it for dog feet. So when I meet him, I says, "George, we're going down to the Hood Link tonight." "Oh, we never make it." I said, "Oh yes, we make it." We fit the dog. I had a couple of rabbits there, and I fit the dogs and made a cup of tea, and then I says, "You get on the sled," and I drive the dogs. And of course, the dogs had a lead then, you see, and we went and we got down to the Hood Link, go around 9 o'clock at night. So I says, "I deck my dogs and I got to haul my stuff in. You can deck," there was a bunch of Indians there, "you can deck some Indians and bring you all the stuff down." So he did. And I loaded up my sled and I took my dogs and I left early in the morning. He was still, we had a cabin there. He was still in the cabin when I left. So I went into Livingston and I told his brother. I said, "You better go out and help George to bring that stuff in." So, and he started out, he got some Indian dogs and he went up to where he had left half the load. When he got there, he had let the fire burn from the night before and the snow melted away, and he had everything in one of these black tonnage bags he had, and he had sugar, flour, beans, rice, oat milk, corn meal, and all stable stuff in that tonnage bag, and that weighed about 200 pounds. And this had fallen over and into the fire, and half of it was burned. Talk about bad luck. Well, he salvaged what he could and put it on the sled and hauled it down. When he came back to the cabin at the Hood Link, in the morning he left and he never locked the door, and the rest of the Indian dogs got in and had eaten up what we brought down the night, the day before. Well, I got into Livingston and I told his brother, I says, "You better go out and help George," and so he went out there. Well, he wasn't back yet, but the brother had found that the Indian dogs got in there and had everything eaten up, you see. What was eatable, you see. And you know what a mess these Indian dogs make, you see. Well, anyhow, George didn't come back. It was late that evening, you see. So Bill, he starts out to look for him. He went up the trail and he found him. You see, he was start out early in the morning to go up there 15 miles and 15 miles back, and he started to make a cup of tea, and he sat on a log and he made a fire and had the teapot on, and then he watched that teapot and he fell asleep. When he woke up, he had burned his moccasins, his pants, his sleeve for his pockets and everything. His face, even his forehead was burned in for him. And on top of it, the axe was leaning a thing, and that fell in the fire. That was the last thing. Isn't that something, huh?
Well, didn't he bring up the cop came after him, didn't he?
Yeah, that was the same trip, you see. Yeah. He, when he was down here in the mouth of the to Kenny. Old Jim Bosch had a camp there all the time. He had a tent there, and he used Jim Bosch's stuff. And Jim Bosch said there was nothing to it. He just a couple of rabbits he took for to him and feed them to the dogs. But, you know, the Jim Bosch was quite a thing, and he sent the police after him. It was not worthwhile even bothering, but I never liked Jim Bosch after that. He got 4 months for it.
No.
Yeah, for a couple of rabbits.
You had to come in with him, didn't you?
Yeah, I came. That's right, yeah. I came in. They deputized me, I had to come in. But this wasn't at all yet. You talk about, he was so played out, you see. When George found him there, sitting on the log, with his clothes burned off him. Yeah, I seen the clothes afterwards, you know. Everything he had, you know, they had, at that time, even was selling the shammy, kind of shammy skin breeches.
Oh, yeah.
And then he had these felt boots. Well, they was all born, and the shammy skin breeches was born all, you know. And the sleeves of his sparker, and the forecap even in front. And the last axe fell over in the back. My... Well, George brought him in to the mouth, to the hood link and in the cabin. And the next day, they went into Livingston. Well, I was going back and forth. I made a round trip every day from Livingston, 15 miles. Every day I made 30 miles. But I was in good shape when I was young, and I had the good dogs and lots of moose meat for the dogs, you know. And I was taking 200 pounds every day. And it was no time I had all my stuff in there, you know. Anyhow, I came out, and there was nobody there at the cabin. They were still over up on the hill, you see, where they camped right there. And the door wasn't in yet when I got there to the cabin. I had a care shop from high up there, no dogs could even build that in the fall. So I usually was home around 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. I was home usually. Well, there wasn't at a cabin when I, so next day I went out and I see the light in their cabin. I know they was home then. They was just about a quarter mile from my cabin there. And anyhow, next time I see him, then Bill told me what happened, and then he showed me the clothes where he had everything burned off, you know. Well, anyhow, before you get to Livingston, there's a stretch, the trail, you've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
The road was cut right through the checkpoint flats and just was surveyed through, you know, so it was straight. But it was in that flat, there was kind of dips down where the river ran at one time or another, you see. And every time when you, especially when you were driving a dog team, the dogs, they had a tendency when they was up and up the hill to stop and rest, you see. And out by the big salmon, there was a ferry across, that was about a mile from where they had the cabin. And you could see it all the way out there, this whole length of a mile, better about a mile and a half, I think it is. Well, Bill, he says, I go ahead and I put the mulligan on and light the fire in the cabin so it's warm when you come in, you see. And so he walked ahead, and George was driving the dogs and had the sleigh. And Bill comes to the cabin, light the fire, put the mulligan pot on, and he thought, well, George should be here pretty soon. He looked out, yeah, he's coming, he sees. All white snow and everything was clear. Now it's all grown up. But anyhow, he go back in the cabin and wait for a while, do something. And, well, why isn't he coming? He look out there. Well, he's still in the same place. So he walk out. Well, when he came up and up the hill, the dog stopped to rest, and he sat down on a sled and he fell asleep, and it was 35 below. If his brother didn't go out there, he would have froze to death. With his clothes all burned off.
Yeah.
quite simple. You know, the talk about tough luck, it's ignorance. Well, it was about 3 weeks later, the mounted police come out. And you see, Jim Bartlett charges against him because he stopped, he took 2 rabbits from there. And he got 4 months for it. Well, at least he spent a good winter in
there. It used to be warm.
Yeah. That didn't bother him. He was a pretty good carpenter, and he done a lot of carpenter. And I often wondered what happened to these boys, you know. And last summer I was down there by the White Bus garage, and I was doing something, and you know Phil Kohler?
Yeah.
Gloria's husband, he came along, and he says to me, "Clem, do you remember a fellow named George Loposchuk?" I says, "Do I?" But he says, "You know, I meet him over in Kelowna." Uh-huh. They was out that summer. And he meet him in Kelowna, he says, and he's retired now. Well, he's a couple of years older than myself, I guess. And his kids are all grown up, and he said he's going to come up. And his brother Bill, I've been wondering, I seen him once in Vancouver years after, but I never found out what happened to him. He talked very slow, and he was in his, all action was that way, very slow, but honest, just the days long, you know, and everything. And I was talking with a guy this summer once, about Dawson. Well, I am not very, very well acquainted in Dawson, and somehow or another, he mentioned Bill Loposchuk. I said, "Is Bill Loposchuk in Dawson?" "Oh, yes," he said, "he's married to a squaw down there." That was that. Yeah. That was the youngest one.
Did you know them,
Dad? Yeah, I remember them. They worked on the dock for a while.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I wondered what... I know George went out to Kelowna there, and that he's up there and that. He was, you remember Captain Gray on the Princess Louis?
Yeah.
Well, two of the McGilvery boys, they came from Britain. And Captain Gray, they came out in 1911 from Britain out to Vancouver. And they started to work for the CPA, and Gray became captain of the Princess Louis, and the McGilvery, George McGilvery, he was just made. And Jack got into trouble on the boat, and he quit, and he came up here to the water. And somehow or another, he got acquainted with Louis Keyser. And Louis Keyser was working over in Livingston. And I think, I forgot now how they got together, but anyhow, Jack had a little money, and he bought a grub stick, and they went over to Livingston. And of course, they never made anything, because old Louis was, he wasn't able to do anything himself, and Jack was never a hard-working man, you know, selling and fishing, and that's all, you know. Didn't know anything about mining, and so they never made anything, but he stayed there. There was a lot of cabins around, and he just moved into one of the cabins, and there was everything there, beds and cook stove and everything. So he get a little gold, and in the time he do a little trapping, you know, and that's all. It didn't take him much to keep going, because He was a man, easy satisfied, and as long as he didn't have to work too hard. Well, anyhow, and he took quite pride about how easy he got along. And one day, the crows, they was so thick around in the fall, right around the cabins, you could shoot them lots of time. But he had a kind of porch in front of his cabin, and it was a nice day in the fall, the sun shining, and he was had a rocking chair there, and he was sitting in the rocking chair and in the porch, and a grouse came walking along. He reached over with the 22 and shot the grouse. And then he didn't want to get off the rocking chair, so he got the fishing line and he threw the fishing line in, out and hooked it in. And right inside the door, he had the cook stove. So he cleaned the grouse there and pulled all the feathers off and cleaned it all out and put it in the frying pan on the stove and cooked it and eat it without getting off that rocking chair. And he was quite proud about it. I remember he was telling Mrs. Caruso about it, and she got mad. She said, "Talk about a lazy guy." Oh my.
Were you there on that step with the host, Mrs. Caruso, or the...
Harry Berry, doing the manager on here, yeah. She was... Harry was mining for years, you know, but she was telling him, she was standing up on the hill, you know, and over to the side, and she was telling him where the pipe is, where to direct the nozzle, and he started for so long, and all at once he got mad, and he put the nozzle on. I was right here.
Well, what was tell Dorothy the line about, I always like this one, about Geary's brother, you know.
Oh, Bill Geary, yeah. Well, you remember the Geary's here?
Yeah,
well, Jim and Lyle was a boy about 5 or 6 years old, and they there's a cabin right on the knoll. The road comes up along the hill, and then right on the knoll there's a cabin there. And his brother was up on Loon Lake. He was hunting for a camp. See, them guys, they didn't have no fresh meat from here, because there was no chance to get any fresh meat in, so they got all wild meat, and he was hunting. He had a couple of pack horses, and he hunted around, and whenever he killed something, he bring it in and sold it to the miners around there. But this particular day, there was Joe Peters and Bob Chestnut and Jim Geary's brother. They have that Lone Lake property. That's a copper property, and they hard rock, and they had been driving a tunnel. They had a nice cabin there, and they had cached a case of powder onto the cabin. And Jim just came along, and he seen a rabbit there. And he shot the rabbit, and the bullet went through the rabbit and into the case of powder and blew it up, and he blinded him. And this is 15 miles from Livingston. But he made his way, he had a dog along, and he made his way down to Livingston, but he couldn't see anything. He had just to feel his way, and when you get to Livingston, the trail leads along the flat, and then you go up along the hillside, the kind of trail leads up there, and what I say, and the cabin of his brother was right on the brow of this hill. And Lyle was playing outside the cabin, and he looked down, and he hollered, "Daddy, there's a bear coming up the trail." The old man had run out with a gun and putting a shot. His brother was coming on all fours because he couldn't, he had to feel his way. Huh? And he lost one eye, and he never even came in here. He cut it off with his pocket knife.
He was just hanging out, wasn't he?
Yeah. Never came into town to see a doctor or anything.
And the sight came back in the other eye?
The sight came back in the other eye, yeah.
You need tough. You get infection or something.
You need
tough. Oh, come on.
Who are the two guys that drove the tunnel there with six shooters on the hips? You know, with the guns on the hips?
Oh, that was Roy Churchill and Ace Officer. They had up on Lake Creek where Tom Caruso was working. Well, they were drifting there, and first there was buddy, you know, and Ace Officer found the fish stick there, and he had another partner, and he made it so miserable for the other partner, so he got Roy in. There was buddy, you know, and so Roy bought the other partner out, you see. And then when they were partners, they couldn't get along, and each one carried a six-shooter in the drink. if you see him picking a knocker, he would shoot him. Oh, God. Talk about characters, you know. Yeah. Oh, that Roy, you remember him?
I remember the name, but I can't.
Yeah, he was working for George Ryder here once in a while, driving the team when George had horses yet, you know. And he worked for D.C. Richard when they had the mill contract here. He finally died down in Dawson, in the old man's home. Oh, yeah. He was... He says, Dick, he came from Montana down there somewhere from the States anyhow. Him and his brother got run out of town down there. He says two elevators put him down. I that's what he told me. I guess they had something to do with it, whatever it was. Yeah.
What was the story again about the discovery of gold in Livingston Creek? George Black was in on that.
Yeah, there was five of them. Louis Keyser, George Black, Bob Chestnut, Joe Peters, and I do not know who else. They came from Dawson, and they came up the Big Salmon, and the first creek they came, well, of course, there was Mendocino, and there was not much, but they came to cut needles. And do you know where that cabin is, when we were there, where Louis had the tractor parked?
Yeah.
Well, they started to bang right there, and they found, Louis Keyser found a pretty good prospect there. So he staked that creek.
Mm-hmm.
He called it Cottonwood Creek off, because Louis was from the Cottonwood country in California county. Cottonwood County. Yeah. And we call it Cottonwood Creek. And the boys, of course, there was no drills then days. They went up the creek and came over the top of the mountain, where we came over from Mendocino. You see, they followed that ridge along, and then they came down Livingston Creek and prospected Livingston Creek. And by God, they found some pretty good. You know where Louis had the bridge built over the piles?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they found some pretty good prospect there. And they staked from there on up. And then they dispatched a recorder to Dawson. That was, they done this all in one day. And the fella went down the valley, down the creek, never looked in the creek, and he went down the valley and down the Big Salmon and down the Dawson. And the next day, the city came up. You remember where these big slides are coming down?
Mm-hmm.
That's somewhere where they camped up there. But the next day they went down the creek, and they said the first day when they was down there is a canyon down there, there's not much use going down there, you see. They prospected the both, and they found pretty good, so they staked five claims, each one a claim, and then they dispatched the recorder. The next day, they went down in the canyon, and they came back, each one with a cap full of nuggets. They was laying right on Pedro. And they had put the crown, you see, them days they could stake 10 claims for themselves and 10 for the crown, 10 for themselves and 10 for the crown.
Mm-hmm.
and they had put the crown ground down in the canyon where they were to reach it. Of course, they picked up all the nuggets then what they could find, you see.
Yeah.
And they tried to catch the guy what went down recording, but they couldn't catch up with him.
Mm-hmm.
He was gone.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the NC company got that crown then, you see.
Mm-hmm.
They borrowed it from the crown.
Mm-hmm.
And the fellow named Black worked it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, did George Black work up there for some time?
Yeah, he must have had a claim there. Maybe he sold it. I never hear him tell that he was working it, but he must have sold it to somebody, because there was quite a few claims above that it was good. Mm-hmm. But it was drifting above, you see.
Mm-hmm.
There was only about two or three claims what was was be able to work in the open work, you know. And then you could see that it's been drifting on the hillside then, yeah.
Old Mike Murphy's story about running the tunnel in a circle.
Oh!
That
uh-huh.
Yeah, that was up on Lake Creek. What I said, Roy Churchill and his officer, they was having that ground. And that was in 1914, and S officer was married, and his wife, I guess she wanted to get rid of him, she wanted him to go to the war, and he did. And Roy had sold out, they was fighting so much, so he sold out to S, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And S owned it outright, the whole thing. And his wife, what I said, she wanted him to go to the war, so he joined up and left Mike Murphy in charge of the ground. Mike left the ground thrown out and staked it for himself. What happened? When S was driving a tunnel, he struck the best trick, and then they was drifting upstream. But there was a downstream quite a ways too, you see. And they was drifting downstream, but there was water coming in and they couldn't work it. They was putting it up to their knees in the water, and so they left that, you see. And there was a patch of ground about 500-600 feet. And it was good in there, you see. And Mike knew that. That's why he let the ground run out and stepped it for himself. He figured that S would be killed in the war and so on, you see. But Mike, a drunken Irishman, never got far enough ahead to get a grub stick to go in there and work this. But Bob Johns, you know Bob Johns, had down here, Second Avenue, he died here about 5-6 years back. He put up the money for the grub stick and he went in with Mike. But when they got there, of course, Mike, when there was no booze left and he drank all the ketchup and the Worcester sauce and the vinegar and everything he could take, and if that was gone, then he was a guy who just nobody could get along with him, you see. So they was fighting all the time, and of course, and Mike was the miner and Johns was just the helper. So in order, they started a tunnel from below, you see, low enough to get into this ground. And after the fight started, Mike figured he's going to do something so they wouldn't get into the bay. So he turned around. He turned around and he came out where he started. And do you know, I worked for Dom Carouche, and we washed that thing out. And we followed that tunnel in, you see. We figured Mike know enough to start low enough to so he get the bay, you see. And we washed that thing down, and sure enough, where Mike started to turn, we only went about 10 feet, and here was the best trick. It was just like a fella was coming along with a book and scared to go, like a fellow, you know, like when a grain sack bursts and the thing, it was just a streak of gold like it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And we worked that out here. Yeah. Tom Cruise got quite a bit of money out of that. But of course, when this was gone, that was the end of it. But they still, farther up, they was drifting upstream, you see. And what I said, Mike was not interested because that was too hard work up there. He wanted to get that lower part was what was easy to be getting, you see. But above, there's still good ground around that. And I know exactly where the end of, I was in that drift too, before it caved in, you know. I know exactly where it is. I think I'm the only one alive today what knows more about that country than anybody. Because all the old timers was there yet when I got there, you see. And they told me everything.
Everyone was
there.
Yeah. Say there was Jim Peters there, Roy Churchill, Percy Sharp, Joe Peters, Harry Berry, Bill Cladro, and Harry Woods. And it was all old timers.
Was Henry Arp in there?
Henry Arp was in, he came in once every summer for a while, you know, just for a little house thing, you know. Yeah, they all was there and they know everything. Like Harry Berry spent all his life in there practically. You know, every hole was stuck and everything and every shaft and every, don't know.
Well, that Miguel Peters you're talking about, the bad community guy, he's not the old boy that died over here that never changed his underwear, is he?
That's the one.
That's the same one?
Yeah.
Tell me about him.
He never took his underwear off, you know. In the following year, he put a new one over the old one. The old one came out in ribbons on the bottom. Smell? I remember Dan Gillis came in once and I had a little cabin there. You seen my little cabin, and Dan came in and he says, holy mackerel, I had to get out of that cabin over there. He said, that man smells worse than a Dutchman Indian.
Well, yeah.
He used to come over to my place and I used to like to play chess and he liked to play chess, but my God, I couldn't tell you, know, he smells a strong.
Can we
show
you those pictures we got of from Elliot
that his dad had taken
over
in 77? No.
Remember Elliot was here in the
50s? Yes. Well, his dad was over there. And work never bothered me much, you know. When you got lots of energy, you know, and people think cutting down a couple of trees is such a choice. This never was any choice to me. No, it wasn't.
I remember you saying I was not letting you work 14 hours a day. Always.
Yeah, it was about, how far is this from the airfield over to our cabin? It was about 2.5 miles.
2.5 miles, isn't it?
Yeah, over a hill, you know, down on the other side and up. Well, you start out in the morning, you take a lunch along, start out 7 o'clock, and go over and cut down trees one after the other, and then you let them dry a little, you know. And then, after we had everything cut down, it took about a month or so, you know. Well, in August, the water gets pretty low, you see. So we couldn't do much work anyhow, so we cut every time we figure there's not much use working, couldn't sleuth much anyhow, we go and cut down for a couple of days. So we train a little, we work a couple of days more, and then we go and cut some more down. Within about 2 years we had a desk to think.
We had a grub hole too.
Yeah. After we had it all cut down, we burned everything, and then I took a man up and we labeled everything up. Yeah.
How long was it going?
Oh, it was about 2,000 feet.
Quite wide too.
Yeah. Yeah, and
what was the first plane to land on?
Washington.
What?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mustn't the first time. Oh, you should have found it. That's good.
Well, did the government ever do any work in there?
Yes, after that, after Lloyd got the captain, you know, he pushed off to the side, you know. But it's not any wider. It didn't make it any wider than we had it, you know. Only there was, it's growing up quite a bit again, you know. It's getting pretty rough. We built a dam in the canyon. We never got up there.
Mm-hmm.
Took us 3 years to build a dam. But we built it. And we could hold the water overnight, and it gave us about 2.5 hours good sluicing, you see. And then we closed the dam, and until around 8 o'clock at night, and then we let it go, and we get another hour sluicing, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then we hoist all the rocks out. You see, everything was washed away, the fine stuff. Pushed all the rocks out, and next morning we was all ready again for sluicing, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And this way we could work much better.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but the dam was about 30 feet high, I guess. All out of timber and filled with rocks and dirt.
And all by hand.
All by hand, yeah. And we never had one piece of equipment to help, you know. The only thing I had was a little sawmill to saw lumber with, you see. And the first 2-3 years we sawed lumber by hand too. But then I made built a sawmill. You still could see the thing there.
Mm-hmm.
But I could cut about 1,000 feet of lumber a day, but you had to get the logs by hand.
Mm-hmm.
I cut the logs in the spring, and I build them, and I put them up high so they get nice and dry, you know. And in the fall of the year, then I pile them up high, all in one pile. And then in the spring, in April when we went in, I make the snowshoe trail do it. And then I had a debarking, and early in the morning I get up around 3 o'clock, and then on the grass, I haul in about 5-6 logs every day until it got soft again, you see. And this way I got all the logs in, and then I started to sow them, when I got all the logs in. Well, there's still quite a bit of lumber there,
mm-hmm.
About 1,000 feet there, I guess, what I had left.
Blue, I don't know, I got 3 o'clock in the morning, early in the morning,
at least tonight. Well, we worked 10 hours a day, not anymore, but we worked hard, you know. There never was any stock for smoke. I never smoked anyhow, but Louis smoked. Never any stock for smoking or anything, just constantly we worked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had a big rock we couldn't hoist, that it was too big, we couldn't lift, then while he was going home and fix a meal, they would go home around 5 o'clock. I go and get a set of steel, and I punch a hole in about 30 minutes, and I blast it by the time after supper we had it ready to hoist it off.
Mm-hmm.
Or off the looms, whatever time it may have been, you know. But never lost any time otherwise, you know. And they always said, well, two big rocks, you cannot handle them. They never bother me, because when I do not, you know, when you put a half a stick of powder is enough to break a big rock like this, if you put a hole in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But if you want to bulldoze them the way they do, just lay the powder on, well, you couldn't have enough powder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, I never had any trouble there in that way. The thing is, I remember was talking with all the guys like out and William and them Swedes. Well, what do you do with the big rocks? Well, I said, they never bother me. You blast them. Well, it takes too much powder. Like, half a stick to blast the big rock, you know, make 3-4 pieces out of it. Well, how can you blast them with a half a stick of powder? Well, I put a hole in. Well, how do you drill a hole? that they did not even know about. They shouldn't even be mining if they did not know anything like that. Yeah.
Do you have any big cleanups in your name?
No, we never had any big. We never. If we made $2,000 a year, that was pretty good, you know. Sometimes we made $1,800, $1,700, $2,000. One year we made $2,400.
It's been a good
year. Yeah.
In those days, that was big money. Pretty good money. Yeah.
That was pretty good money, yeah. Because no matter where you worked on a job, if you made $1,000, that was pretty good money then.
Yeah.
And then you didn't have to work to any work, you see. I mean, you was your own boss. Sure, yeah. You worked 10 hours a day and things, but then was nobody riding you or anything, and you done what you like to do, you know.